future. Trump says you wouldn't be paying these gas prices if he was in charge. Keystone would be under construction. Biden is a disgrace. On and on, going on to talk about Iran and other things. This is actual sort of crisis management done in a really, really strange way. Trump said something for once that's true and for once that's uncontroversial. The people disproportionately dying from COVID are the people without a vaccine, even in the context of Omicron, as we talked about earlier. And Trump's audience is so weaponized against him that they went nuts, and now he's going to Marjorie Taylor Greene to try to help him clean it up. Let's hope that this is Trump's undoing. Trump finally telling the truth about something, maybe his undoing with his own followers. The monster he created is completely out of control and has turned against him, and it is delightful to see. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. Here's a really important topic via voicemail. The YouTube recommendation algorithm. Take a listen to this.
Hey, David, long-time listener. Just had a quick question for you, kind of a philosophical question. With the YouTube ad algorithm, it's incredibly easy for, you know, big right-wing audience or right-wing groups to buy up ad space and blast across and take over political channels. So, for example, if I watch, you know, go to watch a clip of your show, I have to go through a barrier of right-wing advertisements. If I go and watch certain, you know, atheist channels, for example, I have to go through religious ads before I can get to the content.
Yeah, so there's two different things going on here. There's two things going on here. Number one, despite claims of left-wing bias on all of these platforms, Facebook and also YouTube regularly recommend extreme right-wing and conspiracy content, even to people who only are deliberately consuming left-wing stuff. I hear it all the time from my audience. That's number one. But number two, the right buys ads on YouTube in a way that the left doesn't. And I've talked about this before, and the right does this in a lot of different areas. They are willing to sort of have these loss leaders where they say, even if we don't make money by spending money in this way, we're going to do it to bring people in, put people's attention in front of our right-wing content. And so even when you watch left-wing content, you often get ads for right-wing publishers. Why? Because the right-wing publishers are disproportionately buying pre-roll ads on YouTube. And this is part of why they often are doing so well in terms of ground game, because they're willing to train up college grads, right? We talk about the think tanks and the other organizations that they're willing to lose money training people and getting people into their orbit, and YouTube ad spend is just another example of that. I don't know what we can do to change it. I don't know. We have a great bonus show for you today. We'll talk about the new CDC guidelines for quarantine and isolation under Omicron. We will talk about a judge reconsidering a 110-year sentence for a big truck accident that killed four people. And we will also talk about a controversial decision by Tesla. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com and get in.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now,
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And it was strange because I was talking to the box as if my father could hear me, but he did not know what was happening in his beloved Hotel, his beloved Puerto Rico, where ultimately 4,000 people would die, not only due to the hurricane, but of course due to the profound negligence of Donald Trump.
As we continue with our year-end conversations, we speak to the poet Martina Spada, who just won the National Book Award for his collection Floaters. Plus, Arundhati Roy will join us from New Delhi to talk about the pandemic, speaking out against U.S. wars and the state of journalism.
We really need to worry about how we are going to continue, because I think it's probably the biggest thing that's under assault right now in all kinds of ways that 20 years ago we wouldn't have dreamt of.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Eve Goodman. U.S. coronavirus infections have reached an all-time high, surpassing even January's terrible peak, with cases now averaging 267,000 a day and rising rapidly. Hospitalizations are up, too, with nearly 80,000 U.S. hospital beds filled, though that figure is about half the number hospitalized during last winter's surge. On Wednesday, the CDC revised its estimate of the percentage of U.S. Omicron variant infections downward, suggesting the dangerous Delta variant is continuing to circulate widely. The FDA is warning that over-the-counter rapid antigen tests might be less sensitive at detecting the Omicron variant. The warning comes as the Biden administration's preparing to make a half-billion tests available for free to U.S. households. Here in New York, there's been a five-fold increase in the number of children hospitalized with COVID-19 this month. Dr. James Schneider is head of the pediatric care at Cohen Children's Medical Center.
We're seeing record numbers of admissions of all children of all ages, from newborns all the way through 21 years of age, in hospitals and in ICUs with Omicron. Not to say that it's more severe, but it's, my experience so far is that it's not less severe, at least in kids. It's just that it's much more contagious.
In Europe, coronavirus cases have surged to pandemic-level highs in Denmark, France, Greece, Italy, Portugal, and the United Kingdom. In India, hospitals are warning of a new wave of infections with a spike of Omicron infections in the capital, New Delhi. Meanwhile, new data show South America has surpassed Europe as the world's most vaccinated continent, with nearly 63% of adults having received at least two shots. Africa's at the bottom of the list, with just 8.6% of adults fully vaccinated. In Afghanistan, dozens of women took to the streets of Kabul Tuesday, condemning the Taliban's recent attacks on women's rights, including a ban on long-distance travel for Afghan women unless they have a male escort.
The Taliban say, do not enter any car without a man. Where can we get a man? What about widows who don't have a man? Where can they find a man? This is not the proper way. We are not women of 20 years ago. We are educated women, and we will not keep silent under the Islamic Emirate.
Tuesday's peaceful action was violently repressed by Taliban soldiers who fired their rifles into the air to break up the protest. A number of the Afghan women were reportedly injured after the Taliban gunfire set off a stampede. The United Nations envoy to Yemen says the war between Houthi rebels and Saudi-led coalition has escalated sharply in recent weeks, threatening the lives of civilians. Hans Grunberg said in a statement, quote, 2021 is ending on a tragic note for Yemenis, millions of whom are struggling with poverty, hunger, and severe restrictions on their freedom of movement. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas traveled to central Israel Tuesday for talks with Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz. It was Abbas's first visit to Israel in more than a decade. It's not clear what the pair discussed. After the talks, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett told reporters there was no peace process underway with the Palestinians, adding, quote, and there won't be one. Abbas has faced protests among Palestinians after he canceled planned legislative and presidential elections earlier this year. In Brazil, the death toll from unprecedented flooding in the northeastern state of Bahia has risen to 20, with some 35,000 people displaced after a pair of dams collapsed over the Christmas holiday. 81-year-old Victoria Rocha lost her home and nearly lost her life after a town came engulfed with floodwaters.
When I got here and saw the destruction, I could not believe it. It seemed as though what I was seeing was not happening. My home torn apart, all my things destroyed. Everything is a mess.
Here in the U.S., the climate emergency is leading to more extreme winter weather. Alaska set a record high December temperature of 67 degrees Fahrenheit in the town of Kodiak on Sunday, while other parts of Alaska saw record December rainfall with temperatures as much as 45 degrees above average. Meanwhile, in California, Lake Tahoe has recorded more than 16 feet of snow in December, breaking a snowfall record set in 1970. A new report by the charity Christian Aid finds the combined toll of 2021's worst climate disasters cost the global economy nearly $200 billion. Topping the list was Hurricane Ida, which killed 115 people while causing $65 billion in damage. Other costly weather events included the Texas winter storm and intense flooding in Europe over the summer. The report found the six costliest years for climate disasters have all come since 2011, and that without dramatic action to curb emissions, future climate disasters are likely to become much more deadly and expensive. A South African court has ordered Royal Dutch Shell to halt its plans to explore for oil in the pristine wild coast of eastern South Africa. Under the order, Shell must immediately halt underwater seismic tests, which can devastate whales, dolphins, seals, and other marine animals. The court's ruling follows a massive campaign against offshore drilling led by South African environmental defenders. Russia's Supreme Court has ordered International Memorial, one of the country's oldest and most respected human rights groups, to close down. Memorial focused on recovering and preserving the memory of millions of people who were executed, imprisoned, or persecuted during the Soviet era. But Russian officials accused the group of being a public threat, receiving funding from Western powers. Rights advocates have denounced the court's ruling. This is an attorney with Memorial.
We disagree with the decision. We think it's illegal and unjustified. The claim was insolvent, but these kinds of cases have a powerful political motivation.
In Hong Kong, the independent media outlet Stan News has shut down after hundreds of national security police raided its newsroom on Wednesday, arresting at least seven people, including senior staff. Stan News, launched in 2014, was one of the most prominent publications in Hong Kong opposing Chinese one-party rule. In California, the family of Valentina Orellana Peralta is demanding justice after the 14-year-old teen was fatally shot last week by a Los Angeles police officer while she tried on dresses inside a department store's dressing room. Valentina died in her mother's arms. This is Soledad Peralta speaking at an emotional family press conference on Tuesday.
There was nothing I could do. To see a son or daughter die in your own arms is one of the greatest and most profound pains that any human being can imagine.
Valentina and her mother came to the U.S. from Chile about 6 months ago. Her father, the girl's father, Juan Pablo Orellana, recently reunited with his family in Los Angeles. At Tuesday's press conference, he said, quote, "It's like my whole heart has been ripped out of my body." In Colorado, a gunman went on a shooting spree in several locations around Denver Monday, killing five people, wounding two others, including a police officer, before he was shot dead by police. Witnesses to one of the shootings described a chaotic scene as they hid from gunfire in the storeroom of a cell phone store.
There was probably maybe like seven or eight gunshots, and then like another set of maybe five more. Scary. It's scary that this is what goes on nowadays. It's not an uncommon event for there to be public shootings. It's sad. It's scary.
The Gun Violence Archive has recorded 687 mass shootings in the United States this year alone. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. will allow a major January 6th conspiracy case against leaders of the far-right Proud Boys organization to proceed. On Tuesday, District Judge Timothy Kelly rejected claims by Proud Boys leader Joseph Biggs and three other defendants that their actions at the deadly riot were protected by the First Amendment. They face a number of charges, including felony obstruction. Meanwhile, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has agreed to defer its request for hundreds of Trump administration records. The White House has rejected Trump's blanket claims of executive privilege, but Biden administration lawyers argue releasing all the documents could compromise national security and undermine future presidents' claims of executive privilege. And Harry Reid, the Nevada Democrat who served as Senate Majority Leader during the George W. Bush and Obama administrations, has died at the age of 82. During Obama's presidency, Reid shepherded through several major bills, including the Affordable Care Act in 2010 and a $787 billion stimulus package that followed the financial crisis of 2009. Obama paid tribute to Reid Tuesday, writing that he would not have become president had it not been for Reid's encouragement and support. Harry Reid was one of the 77 senators who voted to authorize the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2002. Reid would later call his vote a horrible mistake, telling the Nevada Independent, quote, "It tainted my heart. It was the wrong thing to do, but I was sucked in by General Colin Powell and others, and I believe them, so I regret that. Yes, I do," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the National Book Award-winning poet Martina Spada with this year-end interview. Stay with us.
There's a man, homeless and hungry. There's a wind, it's hard and biting. There's a song in need of singing. There's a fuse in need of lighting. And it's no secret the day is coming. And it's a day I hope to see. But if they ask, ask you, brother, who told you that? You didn't hear it from me. Let freedom ring. Let freedom ring. Let freedom ring.
Tom Morello performing Let Freedom Ring, recorded for Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary celebration. Yes, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our year-end conversations, we turn now to the poet Martina Spada. He recently won National Book Award for his collection of poetry, Floaters. The book honors asylum seekers who've drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande into Texas. Martina Spada became just the third Latinx poet to win the National Book Award. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I recently interviewed Martine from his home in Shelburne Falls. He talked about the title of his book, Floaters.
Well, much of the book focuses on the theme of migrants and migration. And that ranges from the migrants crossing the southern border to the migrants who made their way to Puerto Rico, from Puerto Rico rather, to the United States. And so that encompasses not only Oscar and Valeria, who were the Salvadoran father and daughter who drowned crossing the Rio Grande in June 2019, and then were the subjects of that photograph we all remember that went viral. It also encompasses people like my father, Francisco Luis Espada, Frank Espada, who came to this country in a boat. He too was a migrant, so that makes me the son of a migrant. And so much of the book focuses on that sort of struggle, that sort of survival or loss of life, ultimately some form of transcendence for that community and the descendants of those who cross over. Floaters, by by the way, refers most literally to a term used by certain members of the Border Patrol to describe those who drown crossing over. So where I got it was after Oscar Valeria drowned, and that photograph went viral, there was a post in the I'm 1015 Border Patrol Facebook group alleging that this photograph was a fake. And that's where I saw the use of the word floaters for the first time. And then there was some border activists of my acquaintance who confirmed that this was a term commonly in use. This kind of oppressive force that it's brought to bear on the border has its own vocabulary, and so floaters is a part of that.
Now, you mentioned your father, Frank Espada, himself a renowned photographer, activist, and chronicler of the Puerto Rican migration. He's a big influence on your life, big influence on my life. I met him 60 years ago, and he was a mentor to me. Could you talk about his influence on you, and also, if you can, maybe read one of the poems on the book that where he figures?
Absolutely. My father, Frank Espada, was born in Guava, Puerto Rico, in 1930, died in Pacifica, California in 2014. He was a community organizer. He was a leader. Some people would say the leader of the Puerto Rican community in New York City in the 1960s and early 70s. That was a community of almost 1 million people. He was also the creator of something called the Puerto Rican Diaspora Documentary Project, a photo documentary of the Puerto Rican migration, because he was a great documentary photographer. His work is now included in the collections of the Smithsonian Museum of American History, the Smithsonian Museum of American Art, the National Portrait Gallery, and the Library of Congress. He also published a book by that name, The Puerto Rican Diaspora. And so his photographs hung on the walls of our apartment in the Linden Projects of East New York, Brooklyn, from earliest memory, which means they also hung on the walls of my imagination. And I was able to see from earliest memory and earliest imagination from my youth the nexus between art and activism, the nexus between craft and commitment. To me, it was all one. I thought everybody did it this way. And so my father, although he was a photographer, had a great influence on me as a poet, and as a poet of political commitment, a poet of the political imagination. Well, all this came back for me when Hurricane Maria struck the island of Puerto Rico 4 years ago. We just marked the fourth anniversary of Hurricane Maria. And my father, of course, was already gone. And yet I couldn't help thinking about him. Why? Because suddenly I saw his hometown of Utuado everywhere. I saw it on television, I saw it online, I saw it on social media, I saw it in the articles coming from major publications like the Washington Post. In fact, John Lee Anderson, in the pages of the New Yorker, said that Utuado had become, quote, a byword for the island's devastation. And here I was in Western Massachusetts watching helplessly. And so I began talking to my father. Now, it's not unusual for people to talk to the dead, especially if it so happens you have their corporeal remains in your possession, as I do. I have his ashes in a box on my bookshelf wrapped in a Puerto Rican flag, which is the way he would have wanted it. And so I began talking to the box. And it was strange because I was talking to the box as if my father could hear me, but he did not know what was happening in his beloved Utuado, his beloved Puerto Rico, where ultimately 4,000 people would die not only due to the hurricane, but of course due to the profound negligence of Donald Trump. And so in the poem I wrote for him, I tell him what's happening, but then I call on him to rise again. The poem I ultimately wrote, which is the last poem in this book, Floaters, is called Letter to My Father, October 2017. You once said, my reward for this life will be 1,000 pounds of dirt shoveled in my face. You were wrong. You are 7 pounds of ashes in a box, a Puerto Rican flag wrapped around you next to a red brick from the house in Utuado where you were born, all crammed together on my bookshelf. You taught me there is no God, no life after this life, so I know you're not watching me type this letter over my shoulder. When I was a boy, you were God. I watched from the 7th floor of the projects as you walked down into the street to stop a public execution. A big man caught a small man stealing his car, and everyone in Brooklyn heard the car alarm wail of the condemned, "He's killing me!" At a word from you, the executioner's hand slipped from the hair of the thief. "The kid was high," was all you said when you came back to us. When I was a boy, and you were God, we flew to Puerto Rico. You said, my grandfather was the mayor of Utuado. His name was Buenaventura. That means good fortune. I believed in your grandfather's name. I heard the tree frogs chanting to each other all night. I saw banana leaf and elephant palm sprouting from the mountain's belly. I gnawed the mango's pit and the sweet yellow hair stuck between my teeth. I said to you, you came from another planet. How'd you do it? You said, every morning, just before I woke up, I saw the mountains. Every morning, I see the mountains. In Utuado, 3 sisters, all in their 70s, all bedridden, all Pentecostales, who only left the house for church, lay sleeping on mattresses spread across the floor when the hurricane gutted the mountain the way a butcher slices open a dangled pig, and a rolling wall of mud buried them, leaving the 4th sister to stagger into the street, screaming like an unheeded prophet about the end of the world. El Dualo, a man who cultivated a garden of aguacate and carambola, feeding the avocado and star fruit to his nieces from New York, so the trees in his garden beheaded all at once like the soldiers of a beaten army, and so hanged himself. El Dualo, a welder and a handyman, rigged a pulley with a shopping cart to ferry rice and beans across the river where the bridge collapsed, witnessed the cart swaying above so many hands, and raised a sign that told the helicopters, Campamento Los Olvidados, Camp of the Forgotten. Los Olvidados, wait 7 hours in line for a government meal of Skittles and Vienna sausage, or a tarp to cover the bones of a house with no roof as the fungus grows on their skin from sleeping on mattresses drenched with the spit of the hurricane. They drink the brown water waiting for microscopic monsters in their bellies to visit plagues upon them. A nurse says, these people are going to have an epidemic. These people are going to die. The president flips rolls of paper towels to a crowd at a church in Guaynabo, Zeus lobbing thunderbolts on the locked ward of his delusions. Down the block, cousin Ricardo Bernice's boy says that somebody stole his can of diesel. I heard somebody ask you once when Puerto Rico needed to be free, and you said, 3 pulgadas de sangre en la calle. 3 inches of blood in the street. Now, 3 inches of mud flow through the streets of Oakdwallo, and troops patrol the town as if guarding the vein of copper in the ground, as if a shovel digging graves in the backyard might strike the ore below, as if La Brigada swinging machetes to clear the road might remember the last uprising. I know you're not God. I have the proof. 7 pounds of ashes in a box on my bookshelf. Gods do not die, and yet I want you to be God again. Stride from the crowd to seize the president's arm before another roll of paper towels sails away. Thunder Spanish obscenities in his face. Banish him to a roofless rainstorm in Oakdwallo so he unravels one soaked sheet after another till there is nothing left but his cardboard heart. I promised myself I would stop talking to you, white box of gray grit. You were deaf even before you died. Hear my promise now. I will take you to the mountains where houses lost like ships at sea rise blue and yellow from the mud. I will open my hands. I will scatter your ashes in Oakdwallo.
That's Martín Espada reading his poem, Letter to My Father, the last of the poems in his National Book Award-winning anthology called Floaters.
Martín, I wanted to ask you, you've appeared on Democracy Now! Numerous times over the last 25 years. What has this show meant to you as a poet, academic, and activist?
Democracy Now! Was a place where I could get the truth. Democracy Now! Was always different. Democracy Now! Was not network television. It was not cable television. It was not center to right. It was not mildly liberal. It was a place where I could get the truth, the real story, where I could count on the voices I wanted to hear broadcast, of course, over both television and radio. I can remember many times driving down the road somewhere, going to my next gig, because poets are that way. We're like jazz musicians in that sense. I had put on the radio, and there was your voice, Amy, or your voice, Juan, and it felt like home. Not to mention all the times that I was able to appear on this program and speak my own truth. Not something to be taken for granted at all if you happen to be a left-wing Puerto Rican poet. Kind of a narrow window there. So it's meant all that and more. And I want to acknowledge that on this 25th anniversary to keep telling the truth.
Martín Espada, he recently won the National Book Award for his book of poetry, Floaters. When we come back, the great writer Arundhati Roy joins us from India.
Happy 25th anniversary, Democracy Now! Thank you for being a very important platform for freedom of speech. Felicidades.
Inmigrante! This is a country of immigrants! Gracias, hermano, por todo tu trabajo. Gracias, hermana.
Sola voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correr es mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdida en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen clandestino por no llevar papel.
Saludo de la peligrosa, para la misteriosa por allá en México. Detention centers. Los centros de detención por toda la frontera. Si no peleamos por los niños, ¿qué será de nosotros?
Lila Downs performing Manu Chao's Clandestino for Democracy Now's 25th anniversary celebration. This is Democracy Now. I'm Mimi Goodman. As we turn to the acclaimed writer and activist Arundhati Roy, Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I just interviewed Arundhati from her home in New Delhi. Arundhati, it's so amazing for Nermeen and I to be talking to you, coming really into your home in New Delhi. We see the spiral bookshelves behind you. It's like that's what you ascend your books as you, I guess, travel the world at home right now through the pandemic. But you were on Democracy Now! For the first time like 20 years ago, two decades ago. And then from then on, all the landmark moments. I think of the Iraq War and you coming to the United States and you're speaking around the world against it. Can you just talk about, well, first of all, hello, and Nermeen, join in, hello.
Hello, Arundhati, and welcome back to the show. We really wish you were here in studio with us. Well, I really wish I were in the studio to begin with.
I wish you were at home with me. That would have been nice. It's so strange, isn't it? So intimate in one's home and yet so disembodied. It's such a peculiar time, but what a two decades, you know. And I really, this shouldn't be about me, it should be about you and what amazing work you've done for so many years, you know, for 25 years. How to hold the line. It's you know, at a time when media is in such crisis, not just, you know, structurally, but conceptually, I think. We really need to worry about how we are going to continue, because I think it's probably the biggest thing that's under assault right now in all kinds of ways that 20 years ago we wouldn't have dreamt of, right?
What? I don't know if you explain what you mean by that. What do you mean that, that media, independent media, is under threat in many different ways, including conceptually?
Well, what I mean by that is, of course, independent media has always been swimming against the current. But now, in a way, we have a media that's independent of independent media, right? You have this atomization of how news and fake news and stories are being sort of pipelined across the world. And how does and social media, which is ushering people into echo chambers from which they cannot, they're then sealed into a kind of micro ideologies, and you can't speak across those barriers. And so somehow those of us who do what we do are in the middle of this, you know, on the one hand the giant corporate media, and the other hand this corporatized, atomized social media, which has a very malign algorithms that are, now creating a problem and creating so much information that the human brain can't really process. So how do we navigate our little boat through the storm?
Arundhati, when you first came on Democracy Now! 20 years ago, it was October 19th, 2001. Think about that moment. It was a month after the September 11th attacks, and you had just written a piece in The Guardian titled The Algebra of Infinite Justice, in which you said, America is at war against people it doesn't know because they don't appear much on TV. Before it's properly identified or even begun to comprehend the nature of its enemy, the U.S. government has, in a rush of publicity and embarrassing rhetoric, cobbled together an international coalition against terror, mobilized its army, its air force, its navy, its media, and committed them to battle. The trouble is, once America goes off to war, it can't very well return without having fought one. 20 years ago, right after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan.
And look, I mean, look at the narrative symmetry of what we saw just a few months ago when it withdrew after, in such a shameful way. I don't know what to say, you know, right now, because I remember so clearly the time when I wrote that essay, you know, being told by everybody, don't do it, you know, because, anger was at such a height in the U.S., nationalism was at such a peak, you know, every car was flying four flags, and don't do it, you know, and I just couldn't not write it. But then I learned something, because when I came there, I learned never to confuse, all people with their government, right? So it opened up so many friendships and conversations and relationships that have lasted for so many years. And today I find, one of the things I find most unnerving is that you'll have media, which 20 years ago when I wrote this was just, I remember being at a war tribunal in Iraq and somebody reading out something from a right-wing magazine in India, in the US, where they said, I'll be on the side of anyone who takes a bunker buster to Arundhati Roy, you know, and I said, you know, this is what I mean about the disproportionate use of force. Why a bunker buster when a bullet would do? But now the same media is saying what we were saying 20 years ago. You know, now it's become something that you're allowed to talk about in those spaces. But the trouble is, it's too late, you know. So I just watch people who derided people like myself, who said she should be taking a psychiatrist, she's hysterical, she's crazy, now saying exactly the same thing, you know. And you just, a sort of deep silence settles on me sometimes.
I want to go back, Arundhati, to the point that you were making earlier about the threats to independent media. In an interview, in the collection of interviews with you called The Shape of the Beast, you said, quote, one of the things that needs to be done is for the alternative media to reach a stage where the corporate media becomes irrelevant. Now, you mentioned earlier the fact of this atomizing effect of the social media, which in a way is more pernicious simply because it's accessed by many more people all across the world. So could you talk about this, the importance, the significance of independent media when it faces these almost twin threats?
Yes, because that social media, which appears independent and appears to say that we amplify the voices of the unheard and so on, is actually more corporate than the traditional corporate media, right? So we are now in a situation that where you're between, like I was saying, you're between these two axes, and you take, you take India. You have with, you know, the media, the mainstream media, the television media, the print media, the hundreds of 24-hour news channels, all run basically with corporate money. And then the scandals that are coming out now about Facebook and WhatsApp and their predilection to support the BJP and the right. So you're swimming in such a toxic soup, a 24-hour drip of venom. And there are very, very few, mostly online, and one or two, print media magazines, which you can turn to know what's really going on. All of them sort of bravely trying to stay the course while they are attacked from every direction, you know. So that's the same with Democracy Now! In the US, you know. So you have a situation which I think we don't know how to conceptually even handle, because the amount of falsehood that's been put out, the amount of venom, the amount of poison, it's just fracturing, a country like India. And right now, you know, the one language, one nation, one religion thing is going to tear this country apart, because it is a social fabric built from many communities, many languages, many ethnicities, many religions, and whatever you want to call it, secularism, liberalism, whatever it is, that is the contract that makes this even possible. And if you're going to undermine that by using this media, it's just a question of time before it falls apart, like the Soviet Union did, or like Yugoslavia did, you know, just fractures into little bits. So, and even the people who work in these companies, whether it's Facebook or whatever, they know that they are driving us into a cyclone from which there's no exit, you know.
Arundhati, if you can talk about these 20 years since we first talked to you after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. It didn't just change American society or Afghanistan. Of course, in India, you have this radical anti-Muslim movement also really growing after the 9/11 attacks. Talk about how it shaped India, far larger than the United States, and what you see today as the media covers the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan.
Well, it was a, you know, it was a very important moment, that time when you had, you know, obviously at first the U.S. Funding and stirring up a kind of radical Islam, funding, you know, what eventually became the Taliban, funding the Mujahideen, let's say. The Taliban, of course, came much later. And that had a sort of ripple effect in this region, because obviously at the same time you had in India in 89 the destruction of the Babri Masjid. You had then in 1999 the right wing come to power, conduct these nuclear tests, and the polarization had begun. And very, very interestingly to me, September 11th, 2001, when the 9/11 attacks happened and sort of international Islamophobia was given a free pass, the fascist sort of organization called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, whose ideologues have openly, you know, written admiringly of Hitler, who have referred to the Muslims of India as being like the Jews of Germany, who have consistently asked India to be declared a Hindu nation, and Modi, the current Prime Minister, obviously has been a member of that group since he was a teenager, I think. And in, when 9/11 happened, the RSS saw its moment. And interestingly enough, just within a few weeks, Modi was sort of parachuted into the position of Chief Minister of the state of Gujarat that in October. And the next February, after the burning of a train in which a number of Hindu pilgrims were cruelly, you know, burned to death, and we still today don't know who did that, there was this massacre in Gujarat of Muslims by, you know, Hindu right-wing groups. It was like, you know, thousands of people, 100,000 people driven from their homes, thousands killed, women raped, people burnt alive. And after that, somehow, Modi, who never really came out and apologized for it, was called Hindu Hriday Samrat, you know, the emperor of Hindu hearts, and since then hasn't lost an election. So the wind, they rode the wind, you know. And today we are in a position where I don't know on what grounds India can be called a democracy, you know, because just having elections does not make a democracy. And we have an economy that's floundering. We have hundreds of people in jail, activists, scholars, students, lawyers. Anybody who raises their voice is being put into jail. You may wonder why I'm out. I keep thinking I'm like the inversion of the canary in the coal mine, you know, like, oh, she's saying what she likes, so we must be a democracy. But, you know, comrades of friends of mine are all in prison.
And Arundhati, could you explain the way in which the corporate mainstream media in India has covered these years of the Modi government? As you say, he's not lost an election since he came into power, despite all the issues that you highlight, including, you know, an economic collapse, even if people aren't so concerned about the number of political prisoners. What role has the media played in either downplaying or simply not covering the egregious policies that the Modi government has pursued? You have spoken earlier as well, and in your other writing, in support of some of the few independent media in India, including Caravan magazine, among others, that have tried to make up, to compensate for what the mainstream media and many aspects of social media have not addressed. So if you could elaborate on that, what are the things that have dominated the headlines in the mainstream media, including these massive 24-hour channels?
So let me just start by saying that there are some, you know, online portals like The Wire, like a print magazine like Caravan, like Scroll, like News Laundry, Hindi portals like Jan Chowk, which have, you know, just done amazing work, and I do want to salute them, you know, with very little means and money, but a lot of courage and a lot of intelligence. Now, for the rest of the media, I'll just say this, that Modi himself, to my mind, is a very mediocre person, you know, but with the kind of media support he gets, anybody, you could pick up anybody and make them seem like a genius, and that is what has happened, you know. All the cruelty, all the massive failures of policy, the ambushing of the Indian people as if we are the enemy, you know, with suddenly announcing demonetization, you know, in the middle of the night, suddenly announcing a massive lockdown for corona without having any idea where, you know, the millions of people who live in the cities without, where will they go without food, without work, without money? They'll walk 1,000 miles home, you know. It's as if he doesn't even know what country he's the prime minister of. But all of this is papered over. I wouldn't say that the news is not reported or downplayed. I would say that many of the mainstream media, especially television news anchors, have worked like the captains and commanders of lynch mobs. You know, they have put out false news that has got, you know, young students arrested. They have done things which someday I hope they will be called to account for, because without them, this situation in India would not have arisen. Today, everyone functions out of fear, including people within the BJP. Nobody can say anything, including people, major politicians in the opposition, because all of them fear being jailed, you know, being, you know, framed, being, you know, having their past deeds dug up, and, you know, they are all compromised in some way. So we really are like a one-party system now, you know, and this BJP now today is, I think, perhaps the richest political party in the world, and it has controlled all the levers of power, and all the institutions are penetrated by members of the RSS.
Arundhati, I wanted to ask you about this pandemic that we are still in around the world. You wrote a piece for the Financial Times last year called "The Pandemic is a Portal" that was just quoted everywhere. In it, you said, we can choose to walk through it, dragging the carcasses of our prejudice and hatred, our avarice, our data banks and dead ideas, our dead rivers and smoky skies behind us, or we can walk through lightly with little luggage, ready to imagine another world and ready to fight for it. So talk about what that journey would look like. And do you think anywhere you're seeing that, were you able to accomplish that through this pandemic? What do you want to see at the other end?
Well, no, I wasn't, and I have to say that, you know, that I don't see any attempt, except obviously by individuals and idealistic people, but other than that, I just see you know, imaginations that are just weighed down by their own limitations, their inability to think outside, you know, what people have been conditioned to believe is what the human spirit needs or wants, conditioned to believe what you think of as happiness in the ads you see on TV. So no, I don't see that. Whereas, you know, one has written for years and years about how there are communities and people who ought to be supported and fought for, who do have a different imagination, but they are just being leveled. Still, you know, even when you look at the whole debate on climate change, you just see people able to say something in a seminar room or in a conference or on an international podium for effect. And that same person comes back and you see nothing change. You see no single thing, no single project, no single idea put to rest because, oh, it's going to mean deforestation, or it's going to mean the death of this river, or it's going to mean this landscape, this mountainous landscape is going to be destroyed. No, it's going to go ahead.
Arundhati, one of the most distressing responses to the pandemic has been the extraordinary inequity in access to vaccines. Could you speak about that in the context of not only India, but the developing world in general?
Well, isn't it just so sad? You know, you see that in countries like the US or in many countries in Europe, people are, you know, people who don't want the vaccine are, you know, protesting, and there's so much vaccine just lying around. And in poor countries, that vaccine is just not available. In India, you have a very peculiar situation where almost all the vaccine manufacturing has been entrusted to just one company. And I think India is sort of committed to making vaccines for 92 countries. While here, of course, in June, while people, even in the city I live in, were dying on the streets, were being cremated on the pavements where there were burial grounds and the rivers were full of dead bodies, and people, of course, had not been vaccinated, there wasn't any vaccine. Now, only a third of the Indian population has been fully vaccinated, but we have huge hoardings. In fact, quite soon after the horrible apocalyptic summer that we had, where people were dying in their homes, people were desperate for oxygen, people who asked for it on Twitter were getting arrested for, you know, showing the nation in a bad light. And just as the fires had barely died in the cremation grounds, when the huge hoardings went up saying, thank you, Modi ji, for free vaccine. But in fact, we had a tiered system of pricing for vaccinations. So some are free, some are not. And while the government has committed to supplying these other countries with billions of doses, in India, still the poor are waiting.
And Arundhati, you know, we just have a couple of minutes. We know you just have a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And we wanted to ask about, this is the 25th anniversary of Democracy Now. You've obviously appeared on the show many, many times. Could you say what Democracy Now has meant to you?
It's meant a place to breathe, an oxygen cylinder in the world, which is sort of metaphorically dying of COVID for many years. It's been a place where you can be sure that that you will be met with facts, with intelligence, and the courage.
The great writer Arundhati Roy speaking to us from her home in New Delhi, India. On Thursday, we'll spend the hour with Noam Chomsky, and on Friday, we'll look back at 25 years of Democracy Now! To see our interview with Ed Snowden, go to democracynow.org. Be safe in this new year. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you.
DJ Haim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRC.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett. And I'm Martha Barnett. Grant, of late I've been immersing myself in the language of thru-hikers. Those are those intrepid souls who do things like hike all the way from Mexico to Canada. And I got some terms for you. For example, nobo, sobo, and yo-yo. Any idea what those are?
They're kind of Japanese noodles.
Yeah, I could see ordering some of those and standing
I'm just thinking of soba, I guess.
Right.
What are they? Yeah. So nobo, sobo, and yo-yo.
Yes.
Hiking terms.
Yes.
I don't know.
Well, nobo is someone who's hiking northbound.
Oh, okay. So sobo would be southbound.
Correct.
And yo-yo would mean back and forth.
That's exactly it.
I go up and then I go back.
Yes. Okay. Yes. People actually do this. Here are a couple of other ones that I like. One is zero day, and the other one is Nero day.
So zero day is what, the day you first set out?
Oh, I hadn't thought about it that way, but no. If you take a zero day, it just means that you don't hike that day.
Okay. And Nero day would be?
A near zero day. So you just hike 10 miles or so, not the usual 20 or 30.
Oh, yeah,
30
just 10 miles.
Just
that's
10
nothing.
Miles. A Nero day. But really
that's
good stuff when it comes to the language of hiking. There's some really good stuff, and I want to talk about it some more later in the program.
Well, you know, the show talks about the inside language of everything, sports and hobbies and business and the finance and industry and the military and different things that you do that we've never heard of. We'd love to hear about the inside language of your hobbies and professions. 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org or tell us and the world on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, I'm Natalia, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. Well, hello, Natalia.
Yeah.
Hi, Natalia.
Hey. So I am calling about a phrase that my grandfather used to use before he took my mother for Sunday drives. So he would go, like, right before he went off on their Sunday drives, he would say, oh, well, we're off in a cloud of whale dust. My mom always was like, what in the world does this mean? And she would tell the story to me, and I was just curious, where could this possibly have come from?
Off in a cloud of whale dust, like W-H-A-L-E, whale?
Whale, as in, like, the swimming mammal dust.
A huge swimming mammal that spouts water from its blowhole. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he would use a little bit more of an expletive term at times for dust.
S-H, dust?
No, actually, like, P.
Oh,
really?
I see.
In my research, I found other people asking about off in a cloud of whale dust, which is, I mean, the closest I've come to finding where this phrase comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also heard off in a herd of turtles, or like a herd of turtles in a cloud of whale dust.
That's a good one.
Kind of nonsensical, like, sign-off.
Mm-hmm. And did that mean leaving in any particular fashion, like slowly or quickly or?
I think just in weirdly.
Weirdly.
I think he said it more to make the kids chuckle, and he would always get, like, my grandmother would be like, oh, stop, don't use that language around the kids. Like,
yeah, off in a cloud of whale dust is a phrase that's been kind of dying out. I mean, usually when I see it, it's people who are looking online for what Grandpa used to say. We're off in a cloud of whale dust. And I think it's, you know, just about as nonsensical as the bee's knees or the cat's pajamas or, you know.
Herd of turtles.
Yeah, herd of turtles. It's something that clearly was memorable for you and made the whole family laugh. But as far as I know, it's just a goofy expression.
It's